This week's episode of the Autoblog Podcast is brought to you by the Autoblog Daily Digest. It's a great way to stay updated with what's happening in the world of cars in just 2 or 3 minutes every day. Ask your smart speaker for the Autoblog Daily Digest to stay up to speed with the latest car news, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Greg Migliori. Joining me today on the phones is senior editor for All Things Green, John Snyder. How you doing, man?
I'm doing pretty good. How about yourself?
I'm doing awesome. We thought it was going to be an early spring, and now it's 39 and sort of sleeting outside my house. So it goes. Special guest today, contributing editor Joe Lorio. How are you, man?
Good. How are you guys?
Good, good. Excellent. Welcome to the podcast. Joe does a lot of editing for the site throughout the week. You probably see his byline. He does some, you know, a good deal of freelance writing for us as well. And I believe, Joe, you spent some time in the Aston Martin DBX, right?
I did. The end of last year, I was able to get into the DBX for a little while, which was a nice treat. Mine was like British Racing Green, which seemed sort of appropriate. And Greg, you were also in that car recently, correct?
That's right. Mine was a gorgeous shade of, it was just kind of like a creamy white. The inside was Aurora Blue, they said, and it was $211,000. So it was quite the expensive crossover, but it was fun. It was a lot of fun. I even put a car seat in it. So we've got the DBX in the show. That's one of the spotlight things, but we have another crossover that costs probably a fourth as much, roughly, maybe a third. That's the Audi SQ5. John drove that. I'm excited to get into that because I actually did the launch of that one back in 2017, and this is the first major update basically since then. So that'll be cool. And then we have a new long-termer at Autoblog, the Hyundai Palisade. Joined the Snyder household about a week ago. Mm-hmm. Very excited to see that. It's going to make some road trips as soon as a few days from now. But I cannot wait to take that up north to the UP this summer. And it's a really nice vehicle. It's got a ton of interesting gizmos on it.
Yeah, you're going to love it, man. I'll tell you more about it, but I can tell you right now, it's great. I love it.
Blue the dog is ready for it. She liked the Chrysler Pacifica a couple summers ago. She was not as wild about the Honda HR-V we had a while, like a few years back. Just a little too small for a 60-pound golden retriever. But I feel like the Palisade, we're going to have some room for her in that. So, should be good. Speaking of large SUVs, Jeep Wagoneer, Grand Wagoneer, those vehicles were revealed last week just before the podcast. So we're going to kind of briefly touch on those. Kia EV, it's the EV6. I think that's got an elegant kind of ring to it. I like it. And then BMW told us a little bit about their electric vehicle strategy. Finally, we will spend your money. We've got a great one. It's actually the significant other of the writer from the last podcast. So that's pretty great. Colleen and Jacob. So we're going just back to back here, keeping it all in the family here. So that's kind of fun with Spend My Money. So let's talk about this DBX. The one I drove, like I said, was $211,000. It's got that Mercedes AMG V8 under the hood. I had a lot of fun with it. Like I said, I put my son in it. I did actually shoot a note to Aston real quick just to kind of, hey, I want to put a car seat in this, and this leather looks like it's softer than some steaks I've eaten in my life. Do you mind if I do that? And they're like, yeah, of course. You know, it's a crossover. By all means, I did that. Joe, what did you do with the DBX when you had it last winter?
It sounds like you did more crossover-y kind of things than I did. I drove it just by myself upstate and back on some winding country roads, which was nice. The thing that's really striking to me about the DBX, and it's something that doesn't really come across in pictures, but really only in person, is how dramatic it looks. I mean, we've seen a bunch of different high-end and sports car makers migrate into the crossover space. And, you know, we often bemoan that that move. And, you know, some of with varying degrees, they've done so with varying degrees of success, I think. But I felt like the DBX really looked dramatic. I felt that it really was a successful interpretation of the Aston Martin design language into an SUV shape. It's weird to talk about styling in a media where you're not looking at the pictures, but you know what I noticed when I'm seeing it in person that I hadn't really struck me when I was looking at pictures is the fact that it really has no bumpers. Look at the front of it. It's got the big Aston Martin grille, but not like comically ridiculously big. I think it's kind of sized to fit the size of the vehicle. And the leading edge of the hood, you know, the hood is very long. The leading edge of the hood is the most forward part of the car. So if you like nose it into a telephone pole or something, I mean, it's going to be the front edge of the hood that takes the hit and not any like impact absorbing bumper. And then, but that's, it's a disaster for insurance companies and for your, you know, collision repair costs, but it's what makes it look not like an ordinary crossover. And then the same is true at the rear. You look at the rear, you have that long tapering roof line, and it ends in that kind of really cool, crisp edge shaped that's traced by the taillights. And that trailing edge, again, is the furthest out piece of bodywork. There's no like bumper that that extends beyond it. So again, you know, be very, very careful parking, but boy, it looks good in the flesh.
I would agree with that. I think it looks, to your point, Joe, way better in the flesh than I really expected. You know, you look at the pictures, the press photos, and they really don't do it justice. I was actually just trying to drop a couple of pictures I snapped here into our chat here. Yeah, I mean, I actually didn't notice that until your point there about there really are no bumpers, but I was basically staring at that grill, like when it was sitting in my driveway, and it has, to me, it just look at that like sort of rectangle, if you will, of the grill and the headlights. That's an Aston Martin to me. You know, as you flow farther back, you know, naturally it's a crossover, but this is, I think, the first sort of crossover from a something that isn't traditionally a crossover, like a Porsche, or I was recently in the Mach-E, that I think really, really successfully translated like what the brand should be as a crossover. And where I think
That's exactly it.
They really stuck the landing, I think, like at the back of the car with those dramatic taillights, and it's almost like a tail on the car, which I think is really cool looking. So I think they, you know, just from a design perspective, it's tricky with these things. Like, I honestly thought the Mach-E didn't hold up as well as a crossover in the back. In my conclusion with that car was, it doesn't really matter because it's an electric vehicle. It does all these things for Ford. You know, I drove the ID4, which is kind of a separate thing, but that's totally a microwave crossover. You know, we've all driven like the Macan and the Cayenne, and those are fairly conventional crossovers right now, aside from the taillights and the slightly curved fenders in the back. I mean, Aston Martin, they really went like bumper to bumper, list bumpers, if you will, to make this thing affect what it should be. Even more than I would say like the Bentayga, which I haven't driven, but I've obviously seen it. So, you know.
Yeah, I would agree with that 100%. And it extends to the interior as well. I mean, it's a useful interior. I mean, you put a car seat in it. It has decent back seat room. It has good space up front. But, you know, you get into it, you're opening the door with that flush-mounted, smooth door handle. You open the door, you see it's frameless door glass, you know. So even just the act of getting in, there's a little bit of that kind of Aston Martin sort of, I want to say theater, but like the feeling of you're getting into something kind of exotic, even though it's this practical shape. And then you get inside and you're just hit with that wave of leather smell. It's like walking into like a really good shoe store or something. it's really a snootful, and it sets a tone. There's just leather everywhere. You said your car was blue inside. Mine was like kind of classic orangey tan leather color. So I think that really helps kind of drive the point home. And of course, the whole dash is covered with leather, and it just feels so great and smells so great inside there. It gives you that a real Aston Martin feeling, I think.
I agree with that. I think that's a good point too, in the fact that they managed to pull off an interior that I think looks really expensive. It feels really expensive with, you know, again, mine was Aurora blue with kind of like a tan headliner, and then this very light veneer like accents by the shifter and the center console and all that stuff, or the center console. And it was like understated, but also like not. Like when your interior is blue, I mean, that really kind of hits you in the face. But it was, I would say, more understated compared to, say, some Mercedes and BMWs, Cadillacs. You get all this carbon fiber, this really over-the-top leather, you know, ambient light pipes coming at you every which way. This was just like, oh, wow, that's like a really nice leather interior. And it's all leather. So that was good. You know, I was very careful with this car as far as like, you know, I mean, just, you know, carefully use the hand sanitizer. You don't want to, like, you know, get any like 100 proof, you know, anti-back on these seats or something. But yeah, I mean, inside and out, it was beautiful. And the second row was pretty usable, you know, getting my son in and out of it. I didn't have any problems. I mean, it was definitely better than many crossovers I've used at a variety of price points. You know, you go back to that minivan gold standard and then work your way away from that. Wasn't bad. You know, it wasn't great like any styled up crossover would be, but I didn't hit my head, which is saying something.
And how did you feel about the fact that it uses a, like, Mercedes-Benz interface for the infotainment and that kind of thing?
I was okay.
In my mind, or go ahead.
Well, I was going to say I was okay with that, to be honest, because I don't personally look to Aston Martin to have proficiency in that area. I realize that, you know, I mean, they kind of have to make do with what they can. And if the best they could do is Mercedes, I'm okay with that. You know, I think as somebody who like tries to study the business and knows that AMG and Aston have that kind of alliance, and I think there's an ownership stake even involving, you know, Mercedes and Daimler with Aston, like, I'm okay with that. I mean, personally, I didn't actually love the infotainment system, but I didn't not like it because it was like a Mercedes. I just, the infotainment system in whatever execution it's in, I'm not the biggest fan of it, although it was pretty usable. It was fine. It was better than, say, like Acura's newest system. Let me put it that way. But what do you think? I'm sorry, I cut you off.
I have no problem with the Mercedes system. I think it's pretty user-friendly. I kind of like having a wheel rather than only a touchscreen. I think for, you know, making inputs on the go, it kind of allows you to do stuff a little bit more with your eyes still on the road. So, you know, I was happy to see it there, and I thought it worked well. And like you, I kind of understand that, you know, it's not necessary for these really small volume manufacturers to reinvent the wheel in something as prosaic as an infotainment system.
I really enjoyed the car overall. It actually is one of the, I'd say, like, high performance SUVs that also, you know, it felt pretty quick to me. It handled well. The Mercedes engine was pretty quick and strong. You know, the transmission was good. Like, I mean, I will say this, when you start to think about, to get really like meta here, you know, you need a crossover, like, you're rich, you know, at this point, what do you want? And maybe you're not even comparing, like, you know, abilities and characteristics of the car. You're just like, what do you want? And this is where you start to think about like G-Class, probably your cross shopping, you know, Bentayga. John, have you driven the Bentayga?
I have not.
Okay. You were in like an X7 Alpina or something, weren't you?
Yeah, I was. I was in that, and I was in the Mercedes Maybach GLS 600.
Oh, geez. Okay.
In the last couple months.
all of those kind of apply to this field. You know, I mean, you are talking about differences of tens of thousands of dollars. But again, if that's your rounding error, you probably don't care, you know. So, you know, I mean, even if you wanted to really, really load up a Defender or something like that, just because that
Range Rover.
Range Rover, exactly. You know, there's a lot of things in this segment, give or take $100,000, which is kind of a funny thing to say. I mean, that would be my criticism of this, though, is like, let's just say you really are an Aston Martin customer and you need a crossover, to use the almost like the analogy or comparison that Subaru always said was, well, we're losing all our buyers because we don't have a three-row crossover. Now this allows them as their family grows. You know, I don't know, does Tom Brady really like, geez, I'm an Aston Martin spokesman and I'm out of options in the Aston family. Now I got to go buy something else. Like, I don't really know how much of a real use case that is where the Aston buyer needs a crossover, but I mean, they got to be there. I think at the end of the day, they need a crossover. And I think this is executed better than many of their colleagues have done across the industry. It was fun.
Yeah, I thought it was really executed well. And like you, I really enjoyed driving it. I mean, certainly that 4-liter, 542 horsepower Mercedes V8 is like, that's plenty for most people. And the 8-speed automatic is super, polished. They're able to preserve an athletic response, handling and steering without going super, super stiff with the ride, which you sometimes see with these really sporty SUVs. At the end of the day, though, I mean, as much as I admired the DBX, it also brought to mind a Vantage convertible I'd driven like earlier in the fall, and I was like, you know, as much as I like the DBS, I would still rather drive, the convertible sports car. But that's always going to be the case. So, all that said, I thought it was super well executed and a real surprise.
I do think, to sort of put the other side of my own argument here, if I were in the market for a really expensive SUV and I perhaps was an Aston Martin loyalist, I would get, you know, the DB11 or the Vantage or something, and then I would just load up an Escalade or load up. I actually have a Chevy Suburban in my driveway right now that's basically awesome in every way you need a large SUV to be. I would just go ahead and get the biggest, like, you know, troop transporter of an SUV and do that, rather than probably do it this way and then have my driving enjoyment be in my DB11 and then have my, you know, family responsibilities in the Escalade or the Defender or whatnot.
Or Range Rover. You're probably an Anglophile, really. So you might want to keep it in the Great Britain.
That's true.
Family.
Yeah. Cool. So that's the DBX. Let's, I guess, cross over to the continent and talk about the SQ5, John. Mm-hmm. How much did this thing cost? I guess we're dropping down tax brackets a little bit, but
So this one, it starts at $52,900 before the $1,000 destination charge, but this one was optioned up to almost $72,000, which feels like a lot to pay for a Q5, essentially, you know. But that said, it had like the adaptive suspension and all those goodies, and so it drove really, really well. It didn't feel quite as hot as after coming out of, you know, the SQ8 a couple months ago, but it's a little more sane than that, a little more practical, but yeah, it was really nice to drive. Very sort of car like in its driving. The 3-liter V6, you know, it's very quick, but it doesn't necessarily feel super quick because it's very smooth and it's handling all the power in a very calm way. So it'll dash to 60 in I think 4.5 seconds. 4.4 4.7, something like that. 4.7. And while that's, you know, you can blow the doors off of, you know, everyone else taking their kid to preschool, it just doesn't feel too rambunctious. But yeah, it was a nice car to drive. Having the S-tune suspension really helps quite a bit, especially with those 21-inch wheels on it. It just adapts really well to the conditions, to whatever, you know, sort of driving you're doing. Whether you're driving calmly, going to get groceries with kids in the car, or you want to take it out on some of your back roads and open it up. It's really good at both those things, which I seems to be sort of Audi's MO. I was in the A4 a few weeks back, and it's another one of those cars where it's just sort of a dual nature. Really good at being a comfortable, calm commuter, and then, you know, letting loose when you want to, with the, you know, hit the drive mode button and start using the paddle shifters and have some fun.
Yeah, it's this is one of the first significant like updates for the SQ5 in a few years. I actually did the launch back in 17 in the spring, up in British Columbia, and you know, different time, somewhat different vehicle. But it sounds like the ethos of the car really kind of carry over, if you will, to what, you know, what you're saying there, John. And I think it's, you know, it's obviously going to be a big volume play for them. When I look at the lineup of like the Q5s, if you will, the plug-in Q5 is really intriguing to me, because you get actually better performance and then you can plug it in, obviously. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that to me is kind of, I think, the one I would look at just from a like personal perspective. But from a raw performance perspective, you know, for some people, they're going to want the S like badging and some of the treatments and the looks, and like, to your point, the suspension. So I totally get that. And I mean, like, the S crossovers and sedans, I think, really have good dialed in dynamics as far as the brakes and the steering and things like that. So it sounds like that came through in this one.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's just very, very stable. Not a lot of body roll. Doesn't really get upset over, you know, the myriad potholes on the roads around here. The steering is very precise, and you know, it weights up nicely, and you know, you can sort of tune everything to how you want it if you don't want to stick with the pre-prescribed modes within the sport mode or comfort or whatever. You can pick and choose, which is great. But yeah, like you said, I would go with a plug-in hybrid. Again, you get you know, most of this performance. It's maybe not quite as probably doesn't handle quite as well as this one, but again, it's, you know, it's still very like very comfortable. The thing about the plug-in hybrid is that it's sort of, you can, it's easy to forget that car is a plug-in at all, and it just feels like a normal you know, internal combustion vehicle most of the time. You do, you know, get a little bit of you know, that early torque sort of lets you know, and you can sometimes hear a little bit of the electric motor, but for the most part, it just feels like driving a normal internal combustion vehicle. Kind of like how the Audi e-tron is too. It's an EV. That's like clearly an EV. It's quiet and everything, but it's, Audi doesn't seem to go out of its way to make its EVs feel specifically like an EV. They feel like an Audi first, and then maybe an EV second. They want to have it feel familiar, which, you know, it's an okay move. I personally would like a little more standout from my plug-in vehicles. I want to know that I'm driving an EV or a plug-in hybrid. But anyway, I would still, yeah, I would go with the plug-in hybrid as my first choice. But the SQ5 is perfect for, you know, someone who wants the, you know, more aggressive looks and, yeah, the all the different, you know, handling options you can get for it.
Kind of like the base Q5s, just more like kind of vertical grill and just kind of cleaner looks than the S line. I feel like Audis are getting a little overstyled these days, even just in the few years since I drove the last one. But, you know, I remember it was a good quote from Ralph Giles, who's the head of design for Stellantis. And he said, you know, design is timeless. Good design is timeless. Bad design is timeless. It's still bad design. And I feel like that's sort of how Mercedes and Audi and BMW too, especially, have been really going through this period of, like, I would call it overwrought styling, a lot of curves, a lot of like excess lines, all sorts of things going on with the fascias. And it's fine. You know, the cars don't look plain like they did, you know, years ago, but there's a lot going on there. And I think, if to really kind of go off on a tangent here, I think Cadillac's look with like the CT4, the CT5 is dressed up and clean, toned down considerably from where they were, like with the last generations of, like, you know, the CTS, for example. But, you know, I think it's, I feel like the Mercedes and Audi and BMW, like, block, if you will, has gone a little farther to the other side of that. So
Audi has shown a bit more restraint than the other two, especially inside. Inside the Audi, it's very, very clean, very, you know, sort of modernist, I would say, almost. A lot of clean lines, you know, not a lot of extra curves or, you know, no design for the sake of design. It's simple and it's sort of architectural, and I like that. I like that quite a bit. You know, I do enjoy some of the Mercedes features. BMW can be a little over the top. I once had a boss describe a BMW interior as designy. I mean, the knobs are all like different textures, and it's still the case. They BMW just really really over designs the interiors, in my opinion. And Audi, I mean, you can tell they put a lot of thought into it, but it's just you know, very, very clean.
Well, let's do a bit of a fade here to the Hyundai Palisade, the latest addition to the Autoblog long-term fleet. I believe, Joe, you've driven one as well, and we're pretty excited to add this to the fleet here. So for those of you scoring at home, the Autoblog long-term fleet is the Acura TLX, which joined in January. That replaced the Volvo S60. We're having a lot of fun with the Acura already. It actually arrived in my driveway, and then it's now passed over to road test editor Zach Palmer. John, you get the first crack at the Palisade. What did we get? I honestly don't know. What did we get?
We got the calligraphy all-wheel drive. So the calligraphy is a trim level that they tacked on the top of the lineup that has it's basically the signature with is that what it's called? It's the top trim level plus, you know, some exclusive wheels, you know, some little trim bits here and there.
Does it have the quilted leather?
Yeah, yep, the quilted leather. This has a sort of
Vicra suede headliner.
Yes, it's really, really nice. And this one has sort of a fake birch plastic trim, which not sure if I'm in love with it yet. I know my wife isn't a fan of it, but in all, I think it comes together nicely. The exterior,
I think you guys are.
Go ahead.
You know, I think you guys are going to love the Palisade as a long-termer. I had one a while ago, and I took it on a road trip from New York to Michigan and back, and I anticipate you guys will be doing a lot of road trips with that thing. I think it's a fantastic loaded up long distance road trip machine. If you have the calligraphy, that means that you also have highway driving assist.
Yes.
That's on some of the lower trims as well, but that's like a, I think it's a really, really well executed kind of semi automated steering system for your cruise control. And I was able to use it for hours on end on I-80, some of this kind of straighter, big interstates. On some of the windier highways, like New York 17, it needed a little more minding, but generally it does a great job. It won't do lane changes like the BMW and Mercedes and some of these other ones will, but you know, as long as you have to do your own lane changes. But other than that, I think it does. It's a really nice. It doesn't ping pong back and forth between the lanes. Of course, you know, it's got tons of space inside, including behind the third row seat is pretty reasonable. Mm-hmm. One thing you may have noticed already, but lift up the cargo floor. It lifts up, and then underneath there's quite a big bay underneath. So even if you think like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to get everything in here. Behind this third seat, there's a sort of a hidden compartment there that's actually pretty sizable. And I thought that the infotainment system, you've got the larger infotainment screen, the 10.3-inch one, so you can see three functions at once if you wanted to, which is pretty useful. And then we were able to connect two phones at the same time. So like,
oh, that's cool.
My phone could be the one for... as a driver, could be the one for phone calls, you know, in case somebody called me. But then my wife's phone has better music on it, so she's plugged in, and then we play the music off of her phone. So
that's really neat.
Sort of, yeah, the ability to run both of those at the same time, I thought was another kind of neat feature.
Well, that's very clever. We're gonna have to take advantage of that. We're driving down to the Outer Banks of North Carolina in, you know, a week and a half. And with two kids and two dogs in the car, so it should be fun. But yeah, that's a neat feature. To piggyback on what you said about the assisted driving, it is really, it's one of the better systems I've used. The lane centering is very, very precise, I feel like. And yes, in some of the steeper curves on the highway, you do have to give it a little nudge. But, you know, when it's straight or even, you know, slightly curvy, it really follows the lanes really, really well. It's a great system. And then this has the, you know, the camera feeds for the blind spots when you use the turn signal, which is just a wonderful feature. Really good peace of mind when you're, yeah, making lane changes in traffic, or even when I'm turning into my son's school parking lot, you know, I could sort of see the curb and know I'm not going to curb a wheel. It's sort of a tight little driveway there. So, yeah, it's been really, really pleasant to drive so far, and the use of space is fantastic. That rear cargo space behind the third row is bigger than you see in most three rows. Usually, you know, you can fit like a couple grocery bags behind a third row seat. This you can fit quite a bit more. And those seats, they go up and down electronically. There's, you know, buttons in the back, and so you just hit one of those and it folds flat. You know, fighting with different levers or you know, pull ropes to try and get it in place. It just does it for you. Very, very nice. And yeah, that quilted leather is a nice touch. It really feels like a higher end vehicle than you would expect. This one, the sticker on it is 49,225, which is kind of a lot, but considering, you know, the size of the vehicle and the amount of, it's packed with content. It's got everything. It just feels really, really nice. I would I would put this up against, you know, luxury brands any day. And the infotainment it works well. That displays is crisp. If you are using the touch screen, it's pretty wide, so you have to reach pretty far for some of the controls. But everything's laid out cleanly. I'm looking forward to driving it for multiple hours on end.
One thing that blew me away the last time I drove a Palisade, which was sometime last year, was this is the first time Hyundai has really attempted a vehicle like this, a large three-row crossover that has all of these things and competes at this size. And it's really good, you know.
Well, it does kind of follow in the tire tracks of like the Santa Fe XL or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then there was the Veracruz years ago, but they're just not on the same level as this thing. I mean, this is such a better execution. You know, those were so easily forgettable, and this is really kind of a standout in its field. And a lot of like what you're talking about, John, with the power folding third row seats and stuff, and, you know, the 360-degree view camera and the blind spot view monitor, which, besides on the highway, another great use case for that really is if you're in an urban area, like maybe you're in downtown Ann Arbor or in Detroit, mm-hmm. or someplace, and in the summertime, there's a lot of cyclists around. You're sitting at a light. You're waiting to turn. You've got your signal on. You know, normally you would not be aware of a cyclist coming up on your right along the curbside, and here, like, you see it in the screen. You know, mm-hmm. it's such a great way to have awareness of that, you know. So, and it's got, like you said, it's got all these high-end features, and that really kind of puts it in a field with premium brand products, and that's what sort of makes the price, even at the upper, in the very upper 40s, seem quite reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
This seems like actually a good deal.
Yeah, this is actually maybe not the calligraphy trim, but the Palisade is on the maybe sort of at the top of the short list of cars my wife wants to get. She has an old Mercedes GLK diesel, and now that we have two children, it gets pretty cramped when we go up north. So this road trip will sort of be the test to see, but we might end up with one very similar to the one that's in our driveway right now. We'll see. Even the same color, she wants that. It's like a sort of it's called Moonlight Cloud. It's almost like a dark navy blue. Really,
oh, that's really a nice color.
Yeah.
What? Okay. So Palisade or Telluride? Question for the group, if you had your choice.
You know, I personally like the Telluride design a little better. I mean, it's a little more, looks a little more like a rugged off-roader, whereas this looks more like a suburban family vehicle. They both look great. I believe the Palisade has a little bit more rear storage than the Telluride. But I mean, really sort of take your pick. If buying something made in America is really important to you, the Telluride is made here in America, while the Palisade's made in Korea. But really, I mean, there's not a lot different in the way these drive or in the available content.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. It's really down to a matter of personal preference, which actually almost speaks to the sort of weird brand sort of parallelism between Hyundai and Kia. You know, like, they haven't really defined what makes something a Hyundai versus what makes it a Kia, but that's sort of an issue for them to figure out. In this case, my vote is going to go for the Telluride, mostly for the same reason you said. I just kind of like the sort of squared off utilitarian look of it better. It's just sort of my personal preference for one of those kind of vehicles. And I also like the fact that it has a regular gear shifter rather than an array of push buttons. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I didn't think of that.
That's like a kind of a personal pet peeve of mine against like kind of weirdo gear shifters. So there's not much other reason to pick one or the other. So that it, you know, I'm going to pick it just for those two kind of minor reasons.
Interesting. I really flip a coin on this one. I originally went Telluride, then I like kind of waffled and went back to Palisade. I'm going to go Palisade just to go different here and just to be contrarian. Although I think my actual preference, broad picture, is the Telluride, but just right now my mood is Palisade. And I did actually randomly go to that Telluride factory way back. I think before they made Tellurides, it was on an Optima drive. They made us drive all the way, I forget where we were, but it was like a 5-hour drive to go see the factory, which is cool. That's great to get that kind of context. But man, that was a long drive in a Kia Optima.
Is that the one in, is it in Georgia or Alabama?
It's like West Point, Georgia, I think, if I'm
I believe I went there too. When the, you know, previous or maybe two generations ago, Sorento was coming out toward that factory.
That's very random. We may have been on that same press trip at that.
No, time. I was on that trip with Jeremy Korsinski. Okay.
Well, I would have been for Auto Week at that time, so I would not. It's possible all three of us were there. I don't know. On that note, let's transition to some news from the present decade. We'll kind of run through the segment here pretty quick. Couple EVs, but first let's rehash the Jeep Wagoneer / Grand Wagoneer from last week. Real quick, just initial impressions. What do you think, Joe?
You know, I'm a super fan of the classic Grand Wagoneer, and so I've been waiting for this thing to come for like a long, long time. I mean, Stellantis / FCA they've been promising a new Grand Wagoneer for going back to like the, I don't know, at least like 2014, if not sooner, if not earlier. And it's like, I can't believe it took this long, particularly in a segment where the margins are so rich, you would think that they would want to, you know, get this thing out the door and into showrooms. I think the styling of it is okay. I would have liked to have seen thinner pillars. I'm kind of put off by how thick the B and C pillars are. I sort of like the upright squareness of it. I think the grille is fine. But what's a little bit weird to me is sort of the positioning. I mean, first of all, it has no Jeep badges because they're going to make Wagoneer its own sub-brand, and yet Wagoneer is really kind of stands for the biggest Jeep, so how is it going to be a sub-brand? Are they going to make little baby Wagoneers, and then that would compete with regular Jeeps? It's hard to see what that path forward is there, but I guess they have some plan. And then who else thinks that maybe Wagoneer and Grand Wagoneer, they're both going to have longer versions, sort of like Suburbans as to the current Tahoe. So there'll be like a Wagoneer L, presumably, and a Grand Wagoneer L. And then the division between Wagoneer and Grand Wagoneer is one of fanciness. It seems to me that it would have been kind of easier for people to follow if the Grand Wagoneer was the standard wheelbase, or the regular Wagoneer was the standard wheelbase one, and the Grand Wagoneer was the Suburban-sized extra long one, and then you could just have, you know, trim levels and ascending hierarchy of trim levels within each one of those models. So that's, I think that's a little kind of weird to follow. So those are sort of my initial thoughts.
I'm a little confused by that part of it, just like what you said, Joe, like just trying to like dissect which one is which and where they fit and which one has all the good stuff on it and which one is a little bit smaller. It's a little confusing, and I think it's a little frustrating because one, again, to your point, Joe, I remember Sergio Marchionne said this at the Detroit Auto Show back in 12, 13, 14, talking about this vehicle. He was totally like going off script here and just talking about it, and everybody's quoting him, and the PR guys probably lost their minds because they're like, well, yeah, he just previewed our new SUV that we're not going to build for 10 years. But it's been out there, and they had a long chance to a long opportunity here to get this right. And I feel like they're overthinking it. You know, they're trying to do too much. I totally don't think making Wagoneer a sub-brand is a good idea. That, to me, is like stretching it too far. When, to me, the Jeep brand is great. That's all you need. I mean, that, yeah, to me, is the selling point for this against Chevy and Ford is, okay, a Tahoe is a Tahoe. You know, especially in Michigan, they're so ubiquitous. Suburbans, you know, the Yukon XL. I mean, obviously, when you get one in real life, the GM and Ford products are very, very good. They even feel very premium. Like I said, the Suburban I'm rolling around in this week, I love. It's awesome. But that's also maybe because I love big cars and that sort of thing, big SUVs. Point being is Jeep can be a point of differentiation here. I mean, it's a Jeep. It's cool. And if you look at the front end, I think they get that part of the design right. But then I will literally just say, echo everything Joe said. It falls apart when you start to go farther back with this like troop transporter cage of the back that I don't, it's whatever. Maybe it'll look better in real life. And then again, the trims and the model lineup, way, I think, overthinking it here, trying to do too much. Yeah. What do you think, John?
Well, I think if they're trying to do the luxury thing here, I think, yes, the design could have used a little bit more refinement. I agree that the front, I'm getting used to the front of it, and I like it, I think. But yeah, as you move rearward, it, like you said, those pillars and those windows and the belt line, it's like they didn't put enough time into making it look as premium as they're trying to make this car be. This is gonna take a while because I've had this idea in my mind of the Grand Wagoneer since I was a kid. My dad had one when I was very young, I don't know. This is really different than anything else Jeep has ever done, especially in terms of the interior and the technology and the levels.
Screens.
That, yes. Yeah.
So many screens.
So many. So I don't know. We'll see if they do make, you know, follow through on making Wagoneer its own sub brand. I think that would likely look like, you know, the luxury sub luxury brand of Jeep. But yeah, I don't think that's necessary at all. Just, I don't know, offer higher trim levels in the Jeeps you already have. You know, I don't want to criticize it too much until I actually get in it, because some of these features look super interesting. Like the screen on the passenger side, that could be useful. It depends on how, you know, responsive they are, how how well the menus are laid out and things like that. The controls, the user interface. So I'm gonna sort of cheat here a little bit and withhold judgment. Frankly, because I'm still, you know, still trying to wrap my head around it. I've you know, spent a lot of time just sort of staring at these photos and I don't know, and the prices on it, like the Grand Wagoneer starts at, you know, almost 90,000, which is hard to fathom. But we'll see how it shakes out against, you know, like the Escalade and whatnot. But I do look forward to driving it. I will say that much. I wish there was a plug-in hybrid version.
I agree with you, John, that I feel like once I drive one of these things, I probably will like it very much.
Yeah.
I think that's just inevitably how, especially given my, you know, like I like large SUVs that are capable and have a lot of things on them. I mean, honestly, who doesn't, right? So, you know, there's that. But, you know, look 10 years down the line, we always hear rumors about a Jeep spinoff. Jeep had its own luxury brand. Well, how much more valuable would Jeep in of itself be if Wagoneer was like maybe 3-4 vehicle lineup, with like, you know, Joe's baby Wagoneers dropped in there, you know, expensive ones that are like, I don't know, GLA fighters. Man, I don't know. We need to call up one of our artists to do some red rigs here, the future Wagoneer luxury brand. But I mean, that is one way to like think three moves ahead. Maybe that's what they're thinking.
Or is the idea that the top end version of some of these other Jeeps is the Wagoneer version? So you have like you did at the very beginning of the Grand Cherokee, that they had the wood sided one that was the Wagoneer. I mean, maybe you'd go back to that instead of the Grand Cherokee, you know, limited, Summit, whatever. The top one now is the Grand Cherokee Wagoneer, and the top Cherokee is the Cherokee Wagoneer, and the top Compass is the Compass Wagoneer. Well, I mean, I don't know how far you can take it down, but maybe that's the thinking instead of separate additional models, but I don't really know.
I actually think the wagon, it could be, I don't know. I mean, at this point, we're really spitballing. I actually think they're really changing the Wagoneer meaning too, to go back to like what you mentioned there, John, the Wagoneer that, you know, your dad had. It's like, I don't know. I mean, the Wagoneer was never just some like real cheap thing. I mean, it always had some, you know, attainability, some aspirational qualities, but yeah, I don't know. I feel like they're messing with the meaning of Wagoneer a little bit more than I almost like. perhaps, you know, today's dollars, that means something different. I don't know. I guess I was less worried when Chevy rolled out the Blazer and slapped it on a midsize crossover with a flashy grill, and people were like, oh, the Blazer. It's like, well, okay, whatever. They got to put a name on a crossover. Here you go. They're going to play the hands that they have, the cars that they have. I don't know. Wagoneer, again, because there's so much of a buildup and it's a Jeep, like, you know, there's a lot of things that go into this that make it a little more fraught, I think, potentially, with, you know, how this plays out. And, you know, maybe they'll nail it. You know, give it a couple years and they'll get it all right. Mercedes and BMW, who seem to be the brands that we're criticizing a lot in this podcast without having actually driven them recently, have done a lot of things with AMG and M and changed the meaning of them. And it is inevitably kind of turning out okay. It just took them a while to get the translations right. So, So speaking of BMW, John, why don't you take us through these electrics that they're unveiling?
Sure. Yeah, they just unveiled a pair of electric vehicles, the i4, which is essentially an electric 3 Series. And then the iX, which is kind of this weird looking crossover. And there's going to be a lot more on the way. BMW says there's going to be electric 5 Series, an electric 7 Series, electric X1, probably about when those next generation of those cars are coming around. But yeah, BMW says about 50% of its sales will be EVs by 2030, which isn't quite as ambitious as some other brands, but I think you know, BMW customers do appreciate the gas burning engines in those. So I don't know if the ditching the ICE strategy would work as well for BMW, but they are going that route with Mini. By 2030, all Minis will be electric, and the last gas powered Mini will be launched in 2025. Don't know what it'll be, but then yeah, from then on, they're releasing EVs until it's all EVs, and so we're starting to see the beginning of that now. But yeah, the i4, we don't have a lot of specs on it yet. We do know that the top range will be about 300 miles on a charge, and a 530 horsepower version will do 0 to 60 in about 4 seconds. So it'll be quick. But I'm sure, you know, they're going to have multiple variants with multiple outputs and motor configurations. And the i4 will be coming, it says 2022 model year, so whatever that means. The iX, and you got to look at this thing. It's pretty interesting. It will be here later this year. They're beginning production, and it'll be here delivery starting in about a year from now. This crossover, it's kind of funky looking. It's got that big, huge grill. It sort of looks like the iNext. It's basically picking up that ball and carrying it. Not a lot of features, not a lot of information about that yet either. It will have all-wheel drive with two electric motors and up to 500 horsepower. We'll do 0 to 60 in under 5 seconds. So again, that'll be a quick one. Really interested to get behind the wheel of this iX, because it's just sort of bizarre looking.
It's pretty wild looking, you're right. I think it's interesting to see BMW sort of really get into EVs at this point, at least publicly, and chart what their path is going to be. I mean, they were pretty willing to look at internal combustion engines and diesels for quite some time. And I think obviously they've been working on this electrification strategy for a bit. I mean, they did have the iCars, which they put front and center before a lot of people, mm-hmm. the i8 and the i3. Mm-hmm. The i3 was pretty wild and weird, but
both of those cars were pretty out there, especially for then.
So they've been kind of like playing both ends, if you will, almost like, I don't want to say ignoring climate change, but they were looking at other, hey, we're going to keep these traditional things, but mm-hmm. also we're doing all these other things that other people are doing. So kind of a, incongruent approach, but I think they're kind of, figuring out what their path is. And I mean, I think they're also sort of getting their story right as we look at geopolitical winds and what's going on here. They're definitely getting the right messaging out with these kinds of cars. So we'll see.
We shall see.
EV6, quick thoughts to the room here from Kia.
I'm getting some, I know it's a completely different vehicle, but I'm getting some Kia Soul vibes from the greenhouse of it. It's another one that we don't have a lot of information about, but it's on the new Hyundai eGMP electric vehicle platform that the Ioniq 5 is using. There's going to be that platform is designed with rear wheel drive in mind, with all wheel drive capability. We'll probably see a rear drive and all wheel drive versions of that. But I like the way it looks. It's got that sloping front end, and then that really raked windshield, and the glass house that sort of tapers to the rear, sitting above a really chunky body, really tall doors, really high belt line.
Yeah, it's, to my mind, it's another good-looking Kia, with its really and kind of squat and wide proportions, seemingly, and they wrap around tail lights that then turn down as you go is you come around the side, yeah, and then they meet that sort of rocker panel trim piece that sweeps up, and it sort of virtually connects through where the wheels are, through where the rear wheel arch is. Very interesting, very cool detailing, but like you say, not much information yet on, you know, mechanicals and capabilities. But their styling, I think, continues to really do well.
Another good-looking Kia, that's a good way to put it. I think in some ways this could end up overshadowing the Hyundai version on the same platform, which sometimes Kias do. They tend to show up and they're like they're like wearing the louder suit and the cool hat, and then there's like the Hyundai, which is kind of like Telluride versus Palisade. You know, it's a little surprising how much we don't know about this car, considering it's, you know, we're suggesting it might go on sale as soon as this year even. So it took me a minute there, John, but I see what you're talking about. I do see the roofline of the Soul, like, resemblance there, but it just, it's like a totally different vehicle. So I'm like, what's he talking about? This doesn't look like a Soul. But yeah, I totally see it, and it's very attractive. It's a good looking car. Looks like it'll be a lot of fun to drive. So yeah, I mean, just the EV party is, I mean, it went from like, you know, this like, so, like small elite, like club to, it's like a keg party right now. And I think that's kind of great. That's where we're going. Should we spend some money?
Yeah.
Do it. All right. Absolutely. Let me, this is a long question here. It's a good one. Let me dial it up here. All right. So this one comes from Colleen. Love this here because her boyfriend Jacob actually wrote us in the last episode. So we get to, you know, do a little bit of, you know, help out this couple here. So that's great in back-to-back episodes. So she currently drives a 2006 Honda Pilot EX. She's looking for a new ride. Here's the criteria. Space. She's hauled everything from mattresses to three dogs. In the last 9 years, she's moved four times. So needs a little bit of room here. Appreciates the flexibility with the shape of the vehicle, which is boxy for this 06 Pilot. Also enjoyed having three rows, even though she only used it just rarely. Reliability is important. Obviously, a 2006 Honda Pilot is still running, and it's up to 185,000 on the clock. So that's a great thing. Probably means that there's at least some preference here for Honda. Likes the V6. Let's see, sunroof is a sunroof and leather seats are must-haves. Likes technology, but wants it to be simple. So, you know, not some crazy complicated touchscreen. I hear you. So the budget is about $30,000. Would be willing to stretch up to $35,000, just depending on what's out there. Also, he's just kind of asking, would it be better to buy newer or for fewer miles? Couple other things here. Let's see, the Pilot's AC broke, so we got to get this answered quickly. And here's what the field is. She's looking at Kia Telluride, Honda Passport, Atlas, Toyota 4Runner, Grand Cherokee, 2015 Honda Pilot, and she's also driven a Mazda CX-9 and a VW Golf All-Track. Even considered some mid-sizers like a Mazda CX-5 or a Sorento. Previous Subaru owner as well as a Honda Civic. Okay, I'm out of breath. My voice is getting scratchy. I will throw it over to you, John, for your impressions.
Well, it sounds like a newer Pilot would suit her quite well. You know, if she likes sort of the simplicity of the interior and the utility of it, I think just staying with that nameplate would, if it doesn't sound like she's sick of it, it just sounds like this one's, lived a long and useful life. So I think, that might be what I would do. She has some other, you know, interesting ones on it. The Kia Telluride we talked about, I mean, look at it. If you can find a used one in your price range, you can get a base Telluride in that price range, but if you could find a used one with maybe a little more content, that might suit you better. And then mentions a Sorento, which I really like. The new Sorento starts about 30,000, and gosh, it's really nice. It might not, you know, have quite the space, but it's a spacious vehicle. I mean, it's got a lot of room, not quite as much as maybe what she needs, but it depends on how often she needs to make use of all that space. But honestly, I think sticking with the Pilot and just buying a newer one would be a safe move.
All right. We'll throw it around the horn to you, Joe. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, when people ask for advice on a new car, I mean, the first thing I always say is, like, what do you have now? And how come you don't want to just go get another one of those? And so in this case, you know, it seems like I mean, she's looking at kind of late model used, probably, and she could get a late model Pilot. It would do much of what she is looking for, would do much of what she wants from her new car. So, but maybe she's like, she likes the squarer looking SUVs, like the list that she's given is some of the more squared off ones. And the newer Pilot compared to her original version Pilot, the first generation Pilot is very squared off and utilitarian looking and actually pretty handsome to my mind and in sort of a plainish kind of a way. But the newer one is a little more rounded and maybe a little larger. And maybe that's why she's kind of looking around for casting around for alternatives. If she's gone 185,000 miles with basically just regular maintenance, that sets a pretty high bar for reliability. So one thing that I thought of that would meet that bar would be a Highlander. Particularly, she could get a Highlander hybrid, which would improve on the fuel economy of her V6 Pilot by quite a large degree. It would be a little larger, but not super huge. I mean, in that class of vehicles, like she also mentions the Atlas is really, really big. It's at the larger end, and the Highlander is more in the medium or even medium smaller end. So that's one that I would put at the top of the list to have her check out. A Telluride would be good also, but it's only been out, you know, for not a long time, yeah. So I don't know that there's going to be a lot of used ones
there
hanging
aren't.
Around.
they're hard to find. I was looking, but there are a few out there, but they seem to get snapped up pretty quickly.
Yeah, exactly. And she mentions a 4Runner, like liking the looks of those, but that's going to definitely get worse gas mileage than she's used to, although it would have the longevity for sure. And a Grand Cherokee, you know, would have that kind of utilitarian, sort of straight-edged, kind of handsome styling that she seems to be fond of and would certainly have, like, kind of deluxe features that she was looking for. But I don't know that I would predict 185,000 miles of trouble-free motoring from a Grand Cherokee, a little more maintenance-intensive. So I think the top of my suggestion list would be couple-year-old Highlander hybrid and look for a higher spec one to get leather seats and a great big sunroof.
You'd have to get used to a CVT, though, which she said she doesn't want, but it might be worth the trade-off. Honestly, the CVTs are getting better with every passing generation. And yeah,
well, if she didn't want a CVT, you could always go back and get the regular V6 version.
True.
Which wouldn't be as economical, but still would probably be like a MPG or two ahead of a 2000, a Pilot that's, you know, 15 years old.
Yeah. In my mind, the CVT is worth the trade-off, but if it depends on if that's a hard no for her, but, cause I would go with the hybrid myself personally.
It's an interesting, way to look at it too. Yeah, not being totally sure how she, like, how hard of a no the CVT is, you know, I guess write us back. But a couple of my impressions here are, It seems like there's a bit of a preference for Honda, and I feel like sometimes when you read the spend my money questions, you can sort of almost like try to like read between the lines. So I will slightly confirm, you know, I guess the bias here of saying, sounds like maybe you do want a Honda Pilot, try and find a good late model one, and that could be one of your options. The Passport is different than a Pilot, so you might just want to take a look at that. I found that to be an interesting crossover. I'm honestly not sure if that would be the one. I mean, it probably wouldn't be the one I would personally get, but it's interesting. You might like it. It's a little bit of a different vibe than we generally see from Hondas. So, you know, check that out. That's right in the like $28,000 to like $35,000 range, depending on what year you want or how many miles you're willing to take. Just looking at the Autoblog listings here, there's a 2019 Passport EXL for $31,000. It's in Massachusetts, but you know, they're out there. That kind of fits into that range. And then I would say too, depending on like just where you're at, I would consider a 4Runner just because I really like 4Runners. You know, she mentioned that she likes the look of them. I mean, honestly, if that's where you're going, I would not steer you away from them. They're cool. They're fun.
Reliable. You
know, reliable. Run forever, but they'll run your gas, you know, your fuel economy forever too. So like you're definitely going a little bit into the past with that technology. But yeah, I mean, they're cool. And I mean, honestly, that's why people buy cars. It can be a purchase where you just say, hey, this is what I want. So, I mean, if it were me, I would go drive a 4Runner too, just to kind of see if some of the compromises that you will get with a 4Runner are worth some of the modern amenities of those other two that are probably admittedly more practical on the list. So, yeah. Any final thoughts, guys?
No, I'm just curious to see what she goes with. And
what did you, what was the other car that you put in their driveway last week?
I'd have to double check. I actually don't have that in front of me. But I tell you what, Colleen and Jacob, please write us when you come up to a decision here. We're excited to see what you guys end up with.
We love the follow-up stories.
Yeah, exactly. Take them, don't take them. I actually really like it when sometimes people write in and say, well, you told me to do this, so I did the opposite. Awesome. Uh-huh. That's great. Sometimes just bouncing the idea off of somebody is really quite helpful. But that's all the time we have this week. Joe, thanks for joining us. John, stay safe out there. Everybody, have a great weekend. Send us your Spend My Monies at podcast@autoblog.com. We'll see you next time.